This is Susan Franson, and you are listening to Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Welcome. Today's program is a follow-up to a story on climate change from Local Talk on October 21st, 2013. It's on our website in Archives for 2013 at the Local Talk tab under Programs. That program was inspired by a local rally, Draw the Line on the Keystone Pipeline, which had taken place in September. Today's program was in response to a second rally on February 3, 2014, encouraging people to urge President Obama to deny approval to the XL Keystone Pipeline. I'll play a short clip from Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, which outlines the situation.
A long-awaited report from the State Department has dealt a potential major blow to efforts to stop the Keystone XL oil pipeline. An impact assessment released Friday says the pipeline's northern leg would not have a major impact on climate change. In a speech last year, President Obama said his approval of the project will be contingent upon assuring it does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution. The proposed pipeline would transport 83,000 barrels of crude every day from Alberta's oil sands to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast, which opponents say will have a devastating impact on the planet. The White House says it has yet to make a decision and will await additional feedback from federal agencies. In Washington, State Department spokesperson Marie Harf said the pipeline review will now be open to comments from the public.
As was true with our previous program, our purpose is to present information that will provide new ways to think about the issue, no matter which side you favor. We'll be speaking with Rivka Fidel from ActiveUS, Carl Vondra, Professor Emeritus in Geology from ISU, Stephen Biggs from the Citizens Climate Lobby, with excerpts from a debate between Eric Fika and Cindy Schild on the aforementioned program from Democracy Now! Last fall's program actually began at the rally where I interviewed people standing on the line about their reasons for being there. There were about 30 people on that beautiful September day. As I approached this rally on a cold February evening, I was surprised to see even more than 30 people there. This time, my only interview was with Rivka Fidel, organizer of the student group ActiveUS, about her views on how the situation had changed since last fall.
Hi, I am Rivka Fidel. I'm president of ActiveUS here at Iowa State University. ActiveUS is an environmental and social justice group, and we try to help make life on campus more sustainable.
Well, what's that got to do with the Keystone XL pipeline?
So the Keystone XL pipeline would basically make life everywhere in the United States less sustainable because it would encourage Canada to extract more oil from the tar sands and pipe it down through the United States. And that's a problem for many, many reasons. For example, in Canada, they are literally tearing up the earth to get to these tar sands. They are washing the sands to get the oil off of it with harsh chemicals. And when they're done, the chemicals from the oil and, you know, the ones they've added end up in huge holding ponds. It gets into the water. It harms people. It harms animals. There's just devastation on all levels from extracting this oil. And then when it gets into the pipeline, it's hot, it's thick, it's viscous. And if there is a spill, which is entirely possible given the rates of spills from other pipelines, it will absolutely devastate the area because it is so toxic. And a lot of these areas it's going through are valuable farmlands, woodlands, so it would really be a problem.
As I drove home from the rally, I tuned in to Democracy Now! On KHOI and heard a debate on the pipeline between Eric Fika, a representative of Friends of the Earth, and Cindy Schild from the Petroleum Institute. I was struck by the huge chasm between them. Which one you'd believe would depend more on what you already knew or even their tone of voice, rather than evidence.
Cindy Schild, let's begin with you. Your response to the State Department report.
We have seen the same conclusions. Minimal impacts, negligible impacts, the climate answer, the environmental answer, and concerns have been addressed. This is one factor to be considered amongst several, and it's time to determine that the project's in the nation's interest. When you look at the facts and the science at this point, really, there is nothing left but to determine that it's in the interest of American consumers and our nation to approve this project.
Eric Pica, you have a very different view.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is perhaps one of the most studied pipelines in U.S. history. The problem is that the State Department has been hiring oil consultants to actually assess the pipeline. We've been doing a significant amount of study on the contractor, Environmental Resource Management, who failed to disclose many of their relationships with organizations and companies such as TransCanada and American Petroleum Institute that want this pipeline constructed. So it's really no wonder that the State Department EIS comes out saying that there's minimal environmental impact, and that can be, that's going to be contested because the contractor that wrote this actually is a pipeline advocate.
Who is it?
It's Environmental Resource Management, or ERM for short.
Now, this was a concern you had in an earlier assessment that was done that embarrassed the administration. So why hasn't this changed?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we had exposed the fact that Cardinal Intrex, which was the original contractor 3 years ago who put together the first environmental impact statement, we had done some investigation and actually spurred an inspector general report, and they threw out that old EIS. Now you have ERM, and you thought the State Department would have learned that they need to do better vetting of contractors. Well, through research we've done, ERM failed to disclose on their conflict of interest forms that they had worked for TransCanada over the last 3 years, that they were associated with organizations that advocated for the pipeline, including API, who's on today, who spent $6 million in lobbying expenses in 2013. And so, you know, from an environmental perspective, you know, look, the president's not getting the information he needs because the cards have been stacked against him in the State Department's environmental review process.
Cindy Schild, what Can about this conflict of interest?
Thank you. Thank you. I've been chomping at the bit to respond here. I mean, first of all, the first investigation that you're discussing, what was the outcome of that? There's no wrongdoing. The next one, which we're about to see soon, I expect to see the same thing. If I am going to have an assessment conducted, a proper evaluation of something so significant, I want someone involved that has experience, that has knowledge of the industry, its operations, and the concerns to look for.
One of the strongest disagreements between Cindy Schild and Eric Pica was over the term tar sands, which Schild claimed was inaccurate characterization by pipeline opponents.
Eric Pica, I want to get your response to Cindy Schild saying that the tar sands are not related to tar. That's just rhetoric.
Well, look, I mean, what they do in Canada is, let's be very specific. They log the land, and then they basically strip mine this tarry, dense substance out of the soil.
More dense than other oil?
More dense. This is the densest oil that you're going to produce.
That's been
this is
disputed
the bottom of the
time
barrels.
And time again.
This is the dirtiest oil that they're going to produce.
The State Department even just said it's very comparable to other conventional crudes we refine in the United States.
If you look at the process, if you look at the pictures in Alberta, Canada, this looks like, you know, I'm a Lord of the Rings fan. This place looks like Mordor, because it's just so polluted, so kind of destroyed just to get this oil. It's not the typical oil derrick that you see. This is strip mined, and it's then kind of mixed with other chemicals and then transported. Many of these chemicals are proprietary. We learned in the Kalamazoo spill that, you know, these companies don't report all the chemicals they have to use to make this stuff viscous and or kind of fluid enough to run through the pipelines.
Cindy Schild, can you expand on that, on what tar sands is?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, you know, we had the debate about whether it's oil sands or tar sands, and quite simply, we're producing oil and gas products. There's no tar being produced here. So that's just a terminology, depending what side of the fence you sit on. And, you know, I think as Eric mentioned, you know, he said it clearly, they want the oil to sit in the ground. And it's not going to. The State Department said it, and as do many experts across the board. It's not going to. So we support all forms of energy, but you can't preclude one from another. This is going to come to market, and demand in the United States is going to be what it is. It's going to be met. So that crude source is going to come from somewhere. We believe it should come from Canada and the United States. So when you really, if the environment is the issue that you're concerned with, it's been put to rest.
When Eric Fika charged that the environmental impact statement from the State Department was biased because it was entirely written by people with ties to the Petroleum Institute, Cindy Schild pointed out that it was only people who were knowledgeable about oil extraction who would have sufficient expertise to evaluate the hazards. I concluded that this debate would do little to inform anyone, only to provide justification for whatever opinion the listener already held. It would be a challenge for KHOI to provide real information, but I believe we found two guests who will give us some new things to think about. The first is geologist Carl Vondra, who has a long international career in both academic research and teaching, as well as work with large oil companies. The second is Stephen Biggs, spokesperson for the newly formed Citizens Climate Lobby, who will talk about the economics and politics of those concerned with climate change, but unsure about the most effective actions to take. Now let's hear from Carl Vondra, distinguished professor emeritus, who has a lifetime of experience with the independence that comes from retirement. Thanks for speaking with us today, Carl. I'll ask you to introduce yourself.
I'm a professor emeritus of geology. I came to Iowa State in 1962, and I retired in 2000. But I continued to volunteer both to my department as well as in other areas. I taught courses for the OLLI program here for a number of years. Before coming to Iowa State, I was employed by Chevron in the Gulf Coast in development, actually, and then later by Pan American, which was Amoco, but the exploration company was called Pan American at the time. And that was in Denver, and I worked Western United States in exploration at that time. My areas of interest are a field called stratigraphy, which has to do with the determination of the history of the Earth as recorded in sedimentary rocks, or stratified rocks. That's why it's called stratigraphy. And that field was used in exploration in the petroleum industry, since petroleum occurs in sedimentary or stratified rocks.
What about the so-called tar sands? I heard recently someone from the Petroleum Institute saying they really weren't tar sands. Could you comment on that?
Well, they basically consist of bitumen, and the bitumen occurs in the spaces between sand particles in a unit we call the McMurray Formation in the Athabasca region of Canada. And it's what we would call an immature hydrocarbon, and it consists of the very long chain hydrocarbons. The sand itself contains a great deal of clay as well, which makes it very difficult to remove that hydrocarbon from the sands.
Is that an energy-intensive process to remove it?
Yes. Of course, there's energy involved in mining. This stuff has to be mined. So energy is involved in mining the sands. And then energy, of course, is involved in removing the bitumen from the sand, which is pretty difficult and requires a great deal of water. So I think something like 12 barrels of water are required for every barrel of bitumen that's removed from the sand. And then, of course, the water is a waste product, and it contains a lot of toxic materials that have been dissolved from the bitumen, that occur with the bitumen. And this material is then dumped into tailings ponds, where it evaporates over time. And it may take up to 10, 20 years for it to evaporate before it's solidified. It comes out as a slurry. The waste comes out as a slurry, somewhat like yogurt, about that consistency, because of the clay that's present within the sand. So it's a slurry of water, sand, and clay with a lot of toxic materials in it, both hydrocarbons as well as metallics. that are present in the slurry that are deposited then in these tailings ponds that they're hoping will evaporate over time.
But the bitumen, is that what goes into the pipeline?
It is converted into what they call a syncrude. The bitumen is heated at temperatures up to, up to about 900 degrees and converted into a very viscous syncrude, which goes into the pipelines. And that has to be diluted with conventional oil. I think it's something like a 70-30 combination, 70 parts bitumen and 30 parts conventional oil. Now, the hope is that with this XL pipeline, that it's going to pass through a corner of Montana and then through the Dakotas down into eastern Nebraska, where it will join the older Keystone pipeline, which already exists. So the XL pipeline is really an extension. So the hope is to dilute the syncrude created from bitumen with very light oil that is being derived from the Bakken oil complex in North Dakota and Montana. Oh, there's some up in Canada as well, in the adjoining provinces in Canada. But most of it's coming out of North Dakota and eastern Montana. So those people in Montana and North Dakota are very anxious for the pipeline to be built, because right now they have to transport their oil out of that region by tank cars. There isn't an infrastructure of pipelines to carry it to the refineries. So so they're hoping that the XL extension or XL pipeline will be built.
Well, some of the people. I'm a little puzzled because I recently saw an article about the Lakota people who are very upset because they say this is going over their sacred ground, and they've got a lot of ceremonials and demonstrations. And so can you have any comments on that?
Well, that's true. The Native Americans are generally opposed to it. And there are many people in North Dakota as well as Montana that are opposed to it. I guess maybe I should say the government is more interested in this. The state governments are more interested in this being constructed. And the same problem exists in Canada. The Native Canadians, which I think they call the First Peoples in Canada, are pretty much opposed to it as well. Although the mining of it, there are mixed feelings about it, because the mining of the bitumen, the tar sands, provides employment for many people there, but it also destroys a good deal of their environment. There are mixed feelings about it in Canada.
Could you describe in any greater detail than what you've already told me about the damage to the environment?
There are about 54,000 square miles of area in which the Athabasca tar sands can be developed, and they are covered by boreal forests, native forests, that have to be cut, first of all. And, of course, these forests have a great deal of wildlife with them, so it destroys the habitat for the wildlife. And so once the forest has been cut, we have to remove the overburden on the sands, which varies. In some places, the sands are right at the surface. In other cases, there may be as much as 100 feet of overburden that has to be removed. So several tons of overburden have to be removed before you can mine the sands. The sands are about 200 feet in thickness, so they occur beneath this overburden. And they're mined by huge items of equipment. The trucks can carry many tons of the tar sands that have been mined. It involves a lot of equipment, and the area is essentially destroyed. But, of course, they tell you that they're going to restore this area, but none of it has been restored as of yet. Once the sand has been mined, it has to be transported to places where the bitumen can be removed from the sand. The sand is treated with hot water, and they remove the bitumen from the sand, leaving behind sand and clay that occurs in the sand as well. And, of course, the water then is transported out into huge tailings ponds. And there's something like already 50 square miles of tailings ponds in this area. And the water comes out with the clay and other chemicals and metallics and so on as a slurry, much like much of the consistency of yogurt. And this takes a very long time to evaporate. They hope it'll evaporate. They're talking about decades before any surface will develop on top of these ponds that can be vegetated. So we don't know whether it'll be many decades or may not even occur that we will be able to recover this land and plant vegetation on it. I doubt that any forest will ever grow on this land again.
Before Carl's assessment of future oil development, I'd like to quote from Cindy Schild, Senior Downstream Manager for the American Petroleum Institute. Keystone is just one pipeline. There are 6 proposed pipelines to bring this to market. Since the Alberta oil sands represent the largest source of Canada's gross domestic product, Canadians aren't going to, quote, leave it in the ground, unquote. They're going to get it out. And I'll follow that with Vondra's assessment of future oil extraction.
There's a lot of interest in by the government in Alberta to develop this land, but there are, of course, many people who are opposed to it as well. You know, we've exploited most of the easy sources of conventional oil, so now we're going after the very difficult stuff. And I suspect after the bitumen has been mined, which is going to take decades probably in Alberta, they're going to want to develop the oil shales in the United States, in Colorado and Wyoming, which is even more difficult because rather than being bitumen, it's a hydrocarbon complex we call kerogen, and it's less mature than the bitumen. It would be the first step of organic material being converted to the hydrocarbons that we call oil. So the conversion goes from the organic matter that is sedimented in the sea or in a lake to kerogen, and then it's converted by heat to bitumen, and more heat results eventually in oil. So that's the way that, in a simplified way, that this organic matter is converted into oil.
I have a question about different kinds of oil, because I have been told that not all the oil, even in California, is the kind we're used to thinking of with the oil wells and the pumps. Is there something akin to the tar sands in California?
Well, there are. Yes, there are a number of places in the U.S. where there are tar-like sands or tar-like deposits. So, yes, there are a variety of oil types. And, of course, it depends on the composition of the hydrocarbon that's present in the oil. There are some very short-chain hydrocarbons, which result in very light oils, and then there are some very complex hydrocarbons with very long chains that are present in the more viscous oils. So there's a wide variety of oils that occur. Yes, we'd like to have those with the very short chains that require very little in terms of refining them into gasoline or other hydrocarbons. So the long chain ones are complex and they're more difficult to handle. Many, many problems involved in long chain hydrocarbons.
This is Susan Franzen, and you are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. The subject for today has been the debate and actions on the XL Keystone Pipeline in light of the recent State Department Environmental Impact Statement on this issue. We have just heard from Carl Vondra, ISU Distinguished Professor Emeritus in Geology with many years of experience in oil exploration. This is what he had to say in conclusion to his discussion of the pipeline.
I'm just hoping that the pipeline doesn't go through. It's going to increase the amount of bitumen that's going to be mined. Of course, even if it isn't mined, the Alberta government and the Canadian government is definitely going to move this oil out. They're planning another pipeline, which is the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which is going to go from Edmonton to British Columbia, to the coast of British Columbia, where tankers will come into an area which thus far has been restricted as far as the tankers entering that area. So that's probably going to be even more dangerous than the XL pipeline. The XL pipeline concerns us here in the United States, but this is going to concern the people in Canada, in particular in British Columbia. This pipeline, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, is going through some pristine area. You know, it's glaciers, beautiful mountains, the rainforest. This is all in danger by not only the construction of this pipeline, but the material that's going to be moving through that pipeline, as well as those waters there, those inland waters that occur along the British Columbia coastline. You know, we were very concerned about the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. This is likely to happen in British Columbia, and it's just south of the Alaskan-British Columbia border. So it might even impact Alaska. So this is a real serious problem, I think. I think the Canadian government really should examine that. I know the First Peoples in that area, the Native Canadians, are very upset about that going through there. But if the XL isn't built, that's going to be built. And it may well be built anyway, because China has a great deal of interest in exporting that or importing that oil to China.
Oh, then this really isn't about energy independence for the U.S.?
No, not entirely. In fact, I think a good share of the oil that is transported down to Houston and Port Arthur is going to be exported. So it's going to have very little impact, I think, on oil here in the U.S. Although right now we get most of our oil from our neighbors. You know, we don't get much from Saudi Arabia. We're getting it, or from the Middle East. We're getting it from Canada, and we're getting it from Mexico. Now, we do get quite a bit from Venezuela, which is not our best friend, but still, most of our imported oil comes from our neighbors rather than from the Middle East. So we make a big deal about the oil that we're getting supposedly out of the Middle East, but we're not getting much of them there.
Could you be a window in a darkened hall? To give a passing soul a way of seeing through the wall. People stop in front of you and into you they peer, uncertain what they see because you're not exactly clear. Could you be a lighthouse standing on the shore, meant to send a light out to the sailor in the storm? But even though you show your light, not a boat can tell. You didn't know you're not supposed shine it on yourself. Are you a bell that hasn't tolled, drum that hasn't rolled? A word of hope unsaid, a declaration never read. Oh, are you still afraid to fight?
house standing on a shore that the lost are looking for. That the lost are looking for. That the lost are looking for. That the lost are looking for.
This is Susan Branson, and you are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. The subject for today has been the debate and actions on the XL Keystone Pipeline in light of the recent State Department Environmental Impact Statement on this issue. For a fresh view on the significance of the decision on the Keystone XL Pipeline, as well as what concerned citizens might do about it, I spoke with Stephen Biggs, spokesperson for the newly formed Citizens Climate Lobby.
Citizen Climate Lobby aims to quickly and efficiently transition us away from fossil fuels to clean energy sources. Yeah, so the main proposal is to institute what's called a revenue-neutral carbon tax, which is basically a two-prong strategy. One prong is to institute a fee on all fossil fuels and other energy sources that will emit CO2 into the atmosphere. And the other prong is to return the fee, the monies collected through the fee, to all citizens living in the United States through a dividend program. The idea is that by instituting the fee, which will gradually increase over a series of years, will incentivize people to transition away from dirty energy sources. And by instituting the dividend, will enable citizens to afford the cost and increase in goods that will result from the fee being passed on to consumers in the cost of the goods.
How do you plan to do that?
So there's a few different mechanisms. One is Citizens Climate Lobby is really trying to lobby Congress. So they aim to have a group in each congressional district who works on their member of Congress, or if their member of Congress seems unmovable, like begin to interact with their opponents so that if their opponents can manage to win a race, they'll consider the CCL proposal. So that's one strategy. Another strategy is to meet with members of the local media, media organizations like the Ames Tribune, for example, and explain the CCL proposal and why it's good and why it would be effective in transitioning us to a cleaner energy economy, convince them that they should come out in favor of the CCL proposal, and if not explicitly come out in favor of it, make them more amenable to publishing letters to the editor, for example, supporting the CCL proposal, and thereby generate public support for the CCL proposal.
Now, lobby group has a bad name for a lot of people. Would you explain who your lobbyists are?
Yeah, so I think there's lobby group has a bad name for a very good reason, and that's because the term lobbyist is typically associated with someone who's being paid a whole lot of money to fight for something that they may or may not believe in. They're fighting for it because they're being paid to fight for it. CCL is a community citizens-based organization. Nobody, at least at the local level, is being paid to do any of the lobbying. We're lobbying in the sense that we're trying to persuade our elected officials and local media organizations that the CCL proposal is a good proposal, that it would be effective in transitioning us away from dirty energy to clean energy, that it's important to transition away from dirty energy to clean energy, and that this could all happen without any sort of economic downturn, and in fact with economic benefits.
The reason I'm here with you today is because of last week's No KXL Pipeline vigil. I know that CCL was one of the local groups that sponsored this and that contacted people. Do you have anything to say about that in terms of the likelihood that it will be passed and what happens if it isn't?
I think it's still unclear whether Obama will approve the pipeline. There's speculation that he certainly will. After all, why has he taken so long to say he won't? It seems like maybe he's waiting for public protest to die down so that he can pass it with less political cost. On the other hand, it's been quite a long time that he's been under intense pressure from the oil and gas industry to pass this, and he hasn't done it yet. So it's not clear to me that it will or won't pass yet. And because it's not clear that it will or won't pass, I think it's worth continuing to fight to let him know that people will be very unhappy if it does pass.
Do you see a movement? Do you see anything that would feed into the actions of, say, CCL?
Yes, there definitely is a movement to give this a pipeline. It's a very easy symbol. It's, you know, the oil extracted from the tar sands is incredibly resource intensive to extract. There's beautiful forest over the top of quite a bit of it. It's massive pollution on the local level. Potential to contribute to global climate change is rather significant. So there's many reasons why environmentalists have sort of focused on this particular issue. I think this is very much related to CCL because CCL has a positive proposal to allow us to sort of stop having to fight each individual fight. If the CCL proposal were adopted, if it had been adopted 2 years ago, the pipeline would be no question. There would be no question about the pipeline. The fees levied against the carbon that would be released into the atmosphere from the tar sands would make it cost prohibitive to develop the tar sands. There would be no motivation for anybody to develop the tar sands because it would just cost too much.
Well, that sounds like you're going to have a big fight to stop the carbon fee.
It's actually interesting. So among conservative intellectuals, there's a whole lot of support for the carbon fee. Now, you have to separate conservative intellectuals from conservatives in Congress. Conservatives in Congress often are, in many ways, heavily influenced, to say the least, by special interests. But among conservative intellectuals, there is significant support for a carbon fee. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One reason for that is classic demonstrations of the efficiency of markets, that markets are an especially efficient way to distribute resources, rely on the presupposition that the cost of goods will reflect not just the sort of narrow cost of production, but also what economists call externalities, that is the social cost that has to be borne by the community in order to produce the good. So if you have a business that's dumping a whole lot of toxic chemicals into the river, the cost of their product, if markets are going to be efficient, should reflect the cost, the expense of cleaning up the river so that the community can still use the water. And economists, including conservative economists, think that we need a fee on carbon in order for the cost of fossil fuels to accurately reflect the social cost. So I think you're right that there will be a fight with members of Congress. But one interesting thing about this fight is you have not just sort of liberal intellectual economists and such on board. You have conservative intellectuals on board. So there are many institutes like the Brookings Institute, for example, who have people on staff who are arguing strongly in favor of a carbon tax.
Now, this is different from cap and trade, correct?
Yes, it's entirely different from cap and trade. So one of the sort of fatal flaws of cap and trade is it essentially just created a new market, right? So people could just sell their it allowed people to sell their basically, insofar as they were under the cap, they were able to sell their sort of energy credits to people who were over the cap. And the result was there were enough people under and enough people over that the pricing worked out so that there was no reduction in emissions. Basically, all it did is make money for the brokers who were involved in selling to people the credits from people who were under to the people who were over. Under this proposal, there's a strict increase on the cost. There's a strict fee implemented on any fossil fuel, and more broadly, any energy source that's going to ultimately release a greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. And there's no way around it. You can't, if you're as a company, not consuming a lot of fossil fuels, you can't then sell credits to someone else so that they cannot pay the fee. The fee is universal.
Well, are there already some regulations, anticipated at least, on coal-fired plants? I understand that has something to do with the City Council's recent decision to convert our power plant from coal to natural gas.
Yes, so that's right. So coal is an exceptionally dirty form of energy, and that includes so-called clean coal. And because coal is so incredibly dirty, the Obama administration has put in some extra, basically, taxes against any coal-fired power plant. And that incentivizes communities to move away from coal-fired power plants to other sources of energy. So because of this, Ames Power and Utility decided that it would be less expensive in the long run for them to move away from a coal-fired power plant to a natural gas-burning power plant. What the CCL proposal would do would be this. Because the fee on carbon is going to be increasing over time, investors, including communities, see that in the near future, sources of energy like gasoline and other fossil fuels, and especially coal, the fees will be so extensive that it just will no longer make sense to be using them. So in a decision-making procedure like the one that Ames just went through, where they say, do we stay with coal or do we transition to a natural gas kind of plant, there would be another option on the table, solar. And they could say, look, in the near term, maybe natural gas will be cheaper. But because the fees are going to be increasing over time and significantly, it will be ultimately, at the end of the day, less expensive for us to invest right now up front in solar, so that as the fees are increasing in the future, we have this source of energy that won't be, there won't be as significant fees charged against it.
So we can do that right here in Ames.
Absolutely. And we'd be, the CCL proposal, part of the idea is that it would incentivize us to do it right here in Ames for purely self-interested economic reasons.
So it sounds like the CCL is taking a very practical approach, very market-based, and something that's pretty easy to understand once you get over the idea that this is going to be a new, quote, tax.
Yeah, so it's absolutely a market-based solution to the problem. There are a variety of reasons to think that a market-based solution is the best kind of solution, one of which is that it's politically feasible, whereas other solutions aren't maybe as politically feasible. And by that, I mean, I think it's something we could actually convince Congress to adopt and ultimately the government to adopt if we put enough pressure on the government.
Well, now that the report is out and the press is making comments, I noticed a very interesting report yesterday from the National Geographic News in an article entitled Keystone XL, Is It the Right Fight for Environmentalists? What Happens If President Obama Approves the Pipeline? An article by Laura Parker. Parker quotes Amy Myers Jaffe, an expert on global energy policy at the University of California at Davis, and she cautions that the effort to defeat the pipeline may be misplaced. Quote, the focus should be on regulating carbon emissions nationally instead of trying to block infrastructure. Later this year, the Obama administration has promised to propose regulations limiting the emissions from existing coal-fired power plants, a policy move whose effect on climate change would potentially dwarf that of Keystone XL.
So I think it's absolutely right that we should the environmental movement in general should be focused on developing something like a tax and dividend type of program, like the program that CCL advocates. But I think it's also absolutely right that we should draw a line in the sand with the Keystone XL pipeline. And the reason is this. Developing the pipeline makes sense only if we expect to burn through all of the fossil fuels available to us before transitioning to a green economy. And the reason it only makes sense if that's our expectation is that it's incredibly resource intensive to extract the fossil fuels from the tar sands. And there's plenty of fossil fuels around that aren't resource intensive to extract. So the only way it makes sense to be pursuing this particular fossil fuel is if we expect to burn through all of the easy stuff before, you know, so that we need the hard stuff, you know, we have to have that ready to go too. Because of that, and because everybody in the oil and gas industry recognizes that, we can say, if Obama approves the pipeline, what he's saying to us is we're going to burn through all of the oil on the earth before we decide to transition to a green economy. And that sends a strong signal to investors right now. And the strong signal is keep your money in oil and gas. Don't invest in solar. Don't invest in wind. Don't invest in clean biofuels like switchgrass and algae. Because if you do that, you're not going to see a return on your investment for years and years until all the oil and gas is gone. And we definitely do not want to be sending that signal to investors. If he doesn't approve the pipeline, he sends the opposite signal to investors. He says, look, we're going to be transitioning to a green economy in the near term. So if you want to make a good return on your investment, pull your money out of oil and gas, put it into solar, put it into other green energy sources, and you'll see returns in the near future. And this is an incredibly important moment to be sending that signal. And which signal he sends will have a powerful effect on our ability to combat climate change long term.
Could you be a lighthouse standing on a shore that the lost are looking for? That the lost are looking for. That the lost are looking for. That the lost are looking for.
The following quotation is from the concluding paragraphs of the Des Moines Register editorial on February 12, 2014. Giving the green light to the Keystone XL pipeline should not be seen as an endorsement of burning fossil fuels. It should be seen as a recognition of reality. The reality is this country depends heavily on products made from oil to power our cars, trucks, trains, and airplanes. The extraction, shipment, and consumption of oil comes at enormous cost to the environment, not to mention the military expenditures and wars fought in the Middle East to protect oil supplies. It is like a drug addiction, and as long as there is a powerful craving for oil, the energy marketplace will supply the oil to satisfy our addiction. It is naive to believe it will be possible to cure this addiction by closing one tap at the Canadian border. Without addressing demand, we cannot stop the flow of oil from the Middle East, North Dakota, or Canada any more than we can stop the flow of illegal drugs across our borders. This nation must get serious about reducing its addiction to oil by building vehicles powered with environmentally sustainable fuels, reducing consumption through conservation, improving efficiency, and expanding public transportation. Those measures would make far greater contributions to a greener earth than simply trying to shut off one source of oil.
Last night I was dreaming I was in my GMC. I was feeling kind of empty because it was just a 93. So I filled it full of fossil from the bosom of the earth, which I burned up quite a lot of on my long commute to work, where I worked at what I hated just to keep up with the bills, which I paid to meet the rising cost of feeling unfulfilled, which I felt at every moment with occasional respite, like the times that I go shopping or watch TV shows at night. But I'm waking up. I'm waking up. Waking up, the American dream. Last night I was dreaming of the one eternal hope that my life would be improved if the economy would grow, which already was a monster on a mission to consume. It was eating almost everything and running out of room, and it whispered to me, "Hey mister, here's some products that you need. The standard of your living is too low," and I agreed. So I got myself a credit card with not a penny down, and a long ride and the not so merry money go round. But I'm waking up. I'm waking up. Yeah, the world was like an Amoco, and I said, fill her up for the house, a car, a VCR, a lawn, and all that stuff. But I got an nagging notion that enough did not exist, and at the end of every day I'd wonder, is this all there is? And someone said, hey, you already got 10 times more than the rest, and 6 billion other people want the little that's still left. But I snapped, it's a free country, my rights, it's mine to keep. And by the way, who do I pay to take away this garbage heap? And I'm waking up! I'm waking up! Beginning of the dream was so benign. I mean, all I ever wanted was a smidgen of the pie, some comfort and security and good things for my kids, and okay to please the neighbors and my ego while I did. Anyway, it's great to be awake and feeling satisfied, seeking out the simple and the
deeper things in life than giving to the world instead of hoarding it for me.
Well, I guess I'm not too excited about falling back to sleep. As crazy as it was, hey, was it a dream or not? Just promise that you'll save me if I ever start to nod. Put no-dos in my coffee, throw me outside in the cold. Just don't ever say, okay now, back to bed you go, cause I'm waking up. I'm waking up. I'm waking up.
You've been listening to KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Today, we've been considering the issues surrounding President Obama's decision on the approval of the XL Keystone Pipeline. We've spoken with Rivka Fidel of Active Us, Carl Vondra, Professor Emeritus in Geology from ISU, and Stephen Biggs, spokesperson for the newly formed Citizens Climate Lobby. We also played several short excerpts from a February 3rd broadcast of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman interviewing Eric Fika, president of Friends of the Earth, and Cindy Schild, senior manager of Petroleum Institute's Refining and Oil Sands program, as well as quoting from the February 12th, 2014 Des Moines Register. Songs you heard today were Could Be You and Waking Up by Peter Mayer from his CD Bountiful, and Everywhere by Fleetwood Mac from Greatest Hits. Reporter and producer for this program was Susan Franzen, and please consider listening in to KHOI for future news about things people here in central Iowa are doing to mitigate the effects of climate change while improving the quality of their lives, just like Peter Mayer in Waking Up.
Yeah, the world was like an Amoco, and I said, fill her up for the house, a car, a VCR, a lawn, and all that stuff. But I got a nagging notion that enough did not exist, and at the end of every day I'd wonder, is this all there is? And someone said, hey, you already got 10 times more than the rest, and 6 billion other people want the little that's still left. But I snapped, it's a free country, my rights, it's mine to keep. And by the way, who do I pay to take away this garbage heap? And I'm waking up!